Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, how are you? Welcome to Just the Facts with me, Alex Zane, the podcast that takes a journey through the cinematic CV of a different guest every week to uncover some fascinating facts about their career. And thank you for being here for episode 17. So if you haven't done so already, please do take a moment now to subscribe to our podcast by hitting the subscribe button on whatever podcast platform you use to get each new episode delivered right to your device, into your head, every single Tuesday morning. And for all the latest news and updates about our upcoming guests, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter, where we reside at JTFpod, and you can get in touch with us there as well. And don't forget, if you do like to watch your interviews rather than listen to them, or as well as listen to them, we put the whole video interview up on YouTube the Friday after the podcast is released. That is Just the Facts. Yeah, I know the name of the show. Just the Facts with Alex Zane. That is our YouTube channel. So a quick congratulations then to all our listeners who correctly guessed this week's guest from the clues on our social media. Well done, Tony Cook. Hello, Sammy Croak. Hello, and Gemma Page. Hello, who all correctly worked out that I have a brilliant actor, writer, and director on this week's episode who has just starred in one of the most intense films I have seen this year. It was fantastic having a chat with him. It's the first time we've met. We got into everything from the pros and cons of husky owning to the state of cinema today and the kind of movies that are being made, to the future of planet Earth as we know it, and if we should all be building bunkers in New Zealand. So we covered a lot. We obviously also talked about his role in the brilliant new film that I'm gonna call it a psychological horror here, but we do talk about how that doesn't quite do it justice. It's called Coming Home in the Dark. I watched it at the weekend. Wow. Like I said, it is intense, and once it's got hold of you, it does not let go. And you know how you sometimes think you've seen pretty much everything or every iteration of everything in a film? There is a scene in this that knocks you sideways. Anyway, we have a spoiler-free chat about that movie, Coming Home in the Dark, which is coming out in October. That is Simon barking. Simon! I'm doing the intro. So as I was saying, Coming Home in the Dark is out this October. It was absolutely fantastic having him on the show. So please welcome to Just the Facts, the brilliant Daniel Gillies.
Come here, dog.
That's so funny that you say that, because I'm having exactly the same nightmare with my Whippet Simon at the moment. So your dogs, where are they now? Have you put them away?
I've got a little old girl in the back. She's 17 years old, actually. Just part chow. Yeah, her hips are shot. She's, of course. Well, this is a good thing for me to realize. Can I swear? Probably not, right?
You can swear. It's fine. It's a grown-up show, man.
It is a grown-up show. Okay, I'll put this on. Do not disturb. Okay. Sorry.
That makes me feel better about my headphone issue before we started now. I think somehow, like, fate has created parity once again.
It is. There's nothing hierarchical about this. This is just equilibrium has been restored.
So your dog is 17 years old. That's
one
crazy.
Of them, and I got a 7-month boy, and he's just racing around the property somewhere, like probably just, you know, digging up another tree or eating another outdoor pillow.
How old did you say he was?
7 months.
He's
a husky. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't recommend them. I don't. I love my dog. I'll do my best to be a good father to that dog as long as he's around. But my God, like, there's just so many. The pros are so wonderful. There's also some significant cons. Like, they look ferocious. But they're not guard dogs. They kind of love people, and they're like, you know, you could commit quite an act of theft with huskies guarding the house, you know. he won't poop or pee on the walk. Everything's at home. So basically my backyard is his toilet. They have separation anxiety. So, cause they're pack animals, right? Like all dogs, but like these guys, like to a whole other tier, you know, like I just leave the house in the morning to go get the mail, and he's in the window, and it's like Lionel Richie's playing, you know.
Oh man! So they need a lot of exercise. Huskies. You're in LA, right?
So
where do you teach there? The only place I know that's like, I mean, my experience of LA is fairly limited, but up near the walk up towards Griffith Observatory, up that way, I imagine that's quite a good place to take him out.
Yeah, so I live right near a canyon, and he loves that. But it's about sort of, LA is so dumb. To get to a canyon, you need to find parking, you know, so I have to like park like 4 miles down the street. Now, by the time I get to the hike, I've already, you know, done my hike, you know. It's LA is so silly like that, you know, and we sort of end up driving everywhere. I remember when I first moved here, I thought it was so peculiar that people would be like, hey, I'm just going down to 7-Eleven to grab something, and it might be 3 blocks away, and people, you know, get in their car and drive. It's a strange city in that sense too, because, you know, like, there's no fucking sidewalks, man. There's no pavement. Like, and, you know, in a lot of neighborhoods, and you're like, well, there might be one on one side of the street or not the other. And for a city that's like, you know, primary ambition in the earlier part of last century was to advertise itself as this great land of suburbia, it doesn't really accommodate for pedestrians in any way, right? Like, there's nowhere to walk. I mean, you can in the super wealthy neighborhoods, I guess, but even the super wealthy neighborhoods are often in the hills, and there's no sidewalks, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and the funny thing is, you get the strangest looks when you're walking around LA sometimes, like, just because there's no one else on the street. And I always found it funny the first time I went there that it is a city. I think this might be true of all America, but it's a city that preferences traffic over people, so that even if a man is green, that car can still turn right. So, like, it's a funny one, because until Uber came along, I couldn't get around LA. Like, I visit for work.
Uber, not enough people talk about this, that Uber was actually a saving grace. Like, there was, like, you used to spend so much money on the the most obnoxious ride you'll ever have in your life. You know, you wanted to wash after certain cabs, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember thinking, well, that was $60 just to get here. Like, look, what's the upside? Like, they didn't seem to be reward. Like, everybody drove drunk too. Everybody. Like, it was just done. I was like, how do we get from here to there? And, you know, in New Zealand, we just didn't do that. And I mean, that's quite a testosterone driven culture in New Zealand. It's quite blokey and rah-rah. And there's a certain badge of honor for being a drinking culture, you know.
Yeah.
And yet we didn't drink and drive. We just didn't. No one in my generation did. Like, even if you had a beer. But when I came to the States, I was like, how do we get around? People were like, well, we're just driving to the next place. And we would have had like four or five drinks, you know. It was just that was what was done.
Well, I mean, I've been in cars in LA where people are like, yep, we're going to go. And it's like, but I think part of it is the geography of the city. So you go to a bar for a drink and then people are like, should we go on somewhere? And you're like, hell yeah, let's go on somewhere. And they're like, cool. It's about 40 minutes away down the road. So we're getting back in the car.
That's the thing, isn't it? Like, and so you want to almost pick your spots. Well, the problem with LA is that it's the only major city in the world, I think, that doesn't have a center. Like it didn't, you know, I mean, they tried at the beginning of last century. I mean, that was where all the studios were going to be. And then guys like Chaplin and, you know, said, no, we're going off into the valley because we get way more space for way less money. And they started building. And then of course it was just a sprawling exodus, you know? But yeah, it's the only major city where you can't really pinpoint a center. Although I will say that I think, you know, my kids are 6 and 7. My daughter is Charlotte, she's 7. And my son Theodore is 6. And I suspect if we don't completely annihilate the world in the way that the Greta Thunbergs of the world prophesize, if it's still around at the time that they can party, I imagine that downtown will be the center again, because it's actually kind of fun down there. And more than that, Alex, it's concentrated. You know, it's actually, you can walk from here to there and sort of get to the next bar. You do have to, you know, step around, you know, folks who are incredibly unfortunate in doing so, which is part of the depressing thing about the city too. But but gradually they're getting sort of pushed out of those areas now too, and it's more, it's sort of disseminated and become more of a part of the city everywhere you go. We have a real homeless issue here.
Well, you've got Skid Row down in downtown still, because it's crazy, huh? Because downtown is it's just, you know, gentrification has happened, and all the art community, like often happens when an area starts to become gentrified, it's the artists who move in first, and then after that, all the commercial businesses move in as well. And I visited downtown. I think they've got some crazy plans down there to dam part of the LA River. And I say that in inverted commas because I've never seen something that less resembles a river. But nevertheless, I think they're planning on damming part of it to create a water feature down there to really sort of go, look, downtown has changed. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. I mean, look, and when you talk about like kind of the nucleus of where the homelessness is or whatever, it's not that way anymore. Like the whole city's sort of becoming Skid Row in a way. Like, what's it like where you are? Is there a problem with homelessness where you're in London, presumably, right?
I am. Yeah. So I'm in London, and yes, I would say that weirdly, it looks like it's increased. Or I say weirdly, it has increased due to the effects of the pandemic and the fact that people who previously wouldn't have been in that position have been put in that position by the lack of support, by the consequences of the pandemic. So yeah, it is still a problem in London, very much so.
Yeah, well, and these cities are just so expensive. And also, too, I don't know if England had the same issue, but like, you know, around the mid-1970s, there were a whole lot of people who were sort of cast into the streets when this health system was beginning to crumble. And now, of course, it's just ashes. But in this country, like, there's a lot of people thrust into the streets who psychologically unwell, you know, and that sort of continues to this day.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it's funny that you say that because I was reading an article about LA. I'm fascinated by LA as a city for a lot of the reasons you've just outlined. Like, it's a crazy place. But yeah, apparently, like, areas that previously did not have a homeless problem now have people sleeping rough on the streets. And it's quite a shock to drive around LA, more so than it ever has been previously.
When was the last time you were here?
So it would be pre-pandemic. It was the Oscars 2020, just before it went into lockdown.
You've been here fairly recently, yeah. But I mean, you go under the overpasses and everything here, and it's just like there's not a bridge you can drive under now, like in my area, like where it isn't just sort of tent city, you know. And my kids keep asking, what's going on? Like, why is this happening? Because they just didn't used to be there. They remember when it wasn't like that, you know. Anyway, God, we're really kicking it off.
No, it's interesting. And I mean, you know, having children, have you become more aware of sort of like when you quoted, well, not quoted, but you mentioned sort of the cause that Greta Thunberg is obviously a very vocal a figurehead for. Do you become more aware of the fact that, you know, your kids are going to outlive you, and that you have to maintain like the planet for them? Is it something that became more apparent after you had children?
It sounds like a convenient, I mean, you nailed it. Like, that's what happens. You get, death might be something that occurs to you, but when you have kids, the cycle is really punctuated by that event, right? Like, so when you have, so suddenly you realize, oh, they continue living and I grow old and you know, and die. And there is a sort of responsibility there, right? And it's you're so brutally cognizant of that, like, now. And I'll be honest with you, man. Like, I don't know how much longer I would like to be here. I mean, right now it's these are very expensive bubbles we're living in, you know, and the rest of the United States, well, minus a handful of cities on the coasts, you know, like the rest of the country is significantly cheaper to live in, you know? And like, I don't, you know, like, I think of my life, right? Like, I don't walk into rooms anymore. I don't do meetings. Everything can be done by Zoom. Everything as witnessed here, but you know, like, not that one would make a flight to London to do this, but it's interesting. It's kind of like, it also has like posed the question, like, Jesus, why was I getting in my car before? I mean, my girlfriend is a professional musician, and she teaches as well, you know, and like the amount of times she would get stuck in traffic on the way to her, you know, teaching a student or whatever. She's a cellist. And it's really interesting, just like, yeah, like there are things now when I am discussing with people, like, hey, what are we going to do today? You know, and if there's a meeting involved, like, it's always asked if there's going to be a Zoom now. It's like, why would we get in our cars? You know, I mean, it's probably doing wonders for reducing pollution, but it's just like, this has changed us, man. Like, this experience.
It has. But at the same time, you know, obviously it's fantastic to be able to talk to you on Zoom. And I wouldn't ever have expected you to get on a plane to fly over for 60 minutes and chat. But there would be, I do believe there would, not to do the conversation we're having or about to have a disservice, but there is a difference between if we were sitting in a room together and this. I think fundamentally you can never gauge a person on Zoom the way you can when you're sitting opposite them, just because you understand the rhythm of conversation better. There's something about, you can watch a person's face without a digital screen in front of and understand when they're going to pause, and when, you know, there's something very, very lacking in a Zoom conversation compared to meeting someone.
Did you do a lot? You know, I don't know the origins of your, like, I've definitely heard of you before.
Oh, thanks.
It's just, you know, it's the way it worked out. But did you do a lot of in-person stuff before this happened?
Yeah. I mean, I did not know how to use Zoom before this happened. So yeah, this is all new to me. And despite the fact that I couldn't get my headphones to work at the start of this interview, I am now a competent Zoom user. However, I miss in person. I like in person. I mean, I don't like the formality of in person, you know, because obviously, if we were meeting in person, there were, you know, you'd be here promoting something, there'd be all the hoopla around that, people with clipboards, you know, timings and all the rest of it. We wouldn't be able to have the chat we just had.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to sort of sit down with you and have a conversation.
No, I totally understand that, especially in your line of work. And you require a certain set of skills. I'm making you sound like Liam Neeson.
And I don't mind that. I won't lie. It's the only time in my life I've been compared to Liam Neeson.
For you, you're able to discern like what's going on, how it's moving along, whereas this can be slightly deceptive and people are just in their own universes, you know. I mean, my phone went off just now. Like, it's only a matter of time before my dog scratches the living fuck out of that door behind me.
I've seen him. It's almost like a horror movie. He keeps appearing at the window.
He's the shark in Jaws.
But for you, I mean, have you shot anything during the pandemic, or have you been quiet?
A few things, and it's, you know, and it's been very, you know, controlled. And I shot in the very beginning of lockdown, and that was just like walking into a surgical procedure. Like, everybody was gowned and visored and masked, and you didn't take anything off until the last possible moment that you got into to shoot your stuff. Now it's a lot more relaxed, you know, as a consequence of the vaccinations and stuff. Wait, I need to ask you a question. Has it become as heavily politicized, the vaccinations in England as it is in the United States? Because there's a real division here in this country, like, as in the strangest way that it's become sort of partisan, and as if you know, the conspiracy theorists are like out in force, and actually a lot of people I'm talking about that from the conservative perspective, but on the liberal front, there's just a lot of people who are younger and like particularly young folks who just don't give a shit whether they're carriers or not. I don't know what it's like in England.
It's exactly the same. Exactly the same. I mean, I think it always feels like things happen on a much bigger scale in America in terms of both sides and the drama associated with it. I think even when we are, when people are protesting here, it's never quite as intense as it is in America, because we are quintessentially British. So we'll protest, but we'll protest in a British way. But yeah, it is certainly, lines have been drawn in the sand. And you can meet people who you've known for years, who you would just sort of assume would maybe get a vaccination, get both vaccinations, who will quite happily, without any qualms at all, go, no, I'm not doing it because of X reasons. And they will reel off a lot of reasons that are the hit points that they've read on social media that day or on a conspiracy website. You know, it's a very real thing. And I think if anything, the pandemic has exacerbated it, because more people are spending more time online, not necessarily meeting up with the people that they used to see, who might go, what are you doing? That's mad. They're sitting there on their computer being indoctrinated, it's a strong word, but being convinced of stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was listening to a podcast the other day between Sam Harris and this microbiologist who's sort of like, you know, one of the foremost sort of experts in the world about vaccines and vaccination and the history thereof. And he was talking about what a triumph of modern medicine. It's one of the greatest triumphs in medicine, the speed and the efficacy of these vaccines. You know, like the goal in those trials, which, you know, they labored on. I mean, it was a bit of an arms race, and obviously there's a financial incentive there, though, for the Pfizers and the Modernas of the world. But it's like they were trying to achieve this, and they did in sort of record time. And the goal was like 70% efficacy. The fact that you have these vaccines at 93% and 95%, like it's insane, and that countries are quite literally, like, you know, on bended knee, like begging for vaccines,
and we're here
saying, well, you know, they're like fighting for the right to not have a needle in our arm. It's insane. I really just don't understand it.
And have you got, because it's quite a weird thing to talk about it in the abstract sense, these people who, and this, but have you got friends who've said, I'm not up for this? Have you spoken to them, or does everyone, you know, are they on board with the idea of saving the planet?
Everyone I know. Yeah. I got that Johnson & Johnson, the one and done. I was fine for about 36 hours. And then I just had to go to bed. Like I was like, oh my God, I was wiped out. But the army here in the US were really amazing. They'd sort of mobilized at a local, not a college campus, but like I don't know what you call it, like a community college campus, like nearby. And they were so great, man. They'd organized it beautifully, and there was just such a sense of joy. And in the air, it was a pain in the ass driving into it. It took sort of hours just to you know, you can imagine that the traffic jam. But it was just like, and it was just so swift and beautifully executed once you were in there. The military felt like it was incredible. But yeah, it's been a real, and of course, in the state that I live in, you know, overwhelmingly people are getting the jab, but you know, the middle states in the south, it's become more problematic.
But you know, we were talking about LA, and I mean, you do live there, and we were a little bit down on certain elements of the city, but it is your home, and I think fundamentally you do like being in LA, or are you over it?
Well, so it's the only place that I've ever considered as home, Alex. Honestly, like when I was a kid, I moved from Canada to New Zealand when I was almost five. And I just always felt, you know, like a foreigner, even though, you know, I essentially grew up in New Zealand, but I always felt, just a little uncomfortable there. New Zealand is gorgeous. Don't get me wrong, but sort of grew up painfully aware that it was, you know, it had a real provincial sensibility, which is sort of part of its charm. It sounds incredibly condescending, but it's very small. It's very separated from the world. God, and you know, in the midst of all of this, in the midst of like what looks like a burgeoning apocalypse, you know, there's nowhere else in the world I'd probably rather be.
But well, yeah, you're not alone there, though, are you?
Like, you're not alone. It's, I mean, that country is, you know, if you'd want to be anywhere, it'd be there. But I have to say, there's something that I felt removed, you know, and but I lived in, you know, I stayed in Australia very briefly when I sort of left New Zealand officially, then lived in Canada for a little over a year, and I loved Canada. Canada was wonderful, but just in terms of career opportunities, there was a limit, you know, and you kind of hit the stratospheres fairly rapidly, and the States, there just didn't seem to be a limit. So I stayed here illegally for a long time, you know, and just slept on couches and whatnot in order to stay here, because it felt like home. I mean, I remember driving in after, like, I'd been living in Vancouver at the time for something like, you know, a little over a year, as I said, but there was 6 or 7 months of like straight rain, and then it was almost like the clouds parted and there was sunshine here. And I'd read about it. I knew that LA had wonderful weather, but it was just like day after day of beautiful weather. And I thought I'd just gotten lucky, but it's actually just the way it is. Also too, I was 25, 26 years old and driving around and seeing the girls, between the girls and the weather, I was just like, I think I'm weighing anchor. I think this is. Yeah, and it's felt like home for, you know, ever since, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to what it must have been like living in New Zealand, because like you say, you do. I've been a few times, and you do feel like you are at the ends of the earth, which is both good and bad. But yeah. I went to Christchurch, and that did feel like I was stepping back into the 1950s. It's a crazy place there, yeah. But it's funny that you, like you say, like now is the time you'd want to be there. Cause I think I was reading the other day, a lot of the tech billionaires are currently in the process of building their end of the world bunkers out in New Zealand. So that when this actually goes to the next level and, you know, it's riots on the streets and the end of the world is nigh, they're going to go to their bolt holes in the New Zealand mountains outside Queensland, not Queensland, Queenstown.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Shame on you.
Yo, come on, that's not bad. I got there in the end. But yeah, I like it out there. I was a proper tourist when I was out there. I did the whole Hobbiton, Middle Earth, Lord of the Rings tour, that whole shebang. I mean, it's great, but it's slightly touristy.
My kids keep asking to go there. They haven't been there yet. And I'm I had planned to, but then the pandemic hit. Yeah, I'm reading them The Hobbit at the moment. Actually, we're actually on the final chapter as of last night, and they're so excited. And I told them about New Zealand and that you can go and visit the Shire and stuff like that. They're just, for that alone, they want to get on a plane for 27 hours or whatever it is.
I mean, I'm an adult man, but drinking a beer in the Green Dragon in the Shire.
Oh, you can do that? Oh, God, you I didn't know that. That sounds amazing. Okay.
It's great stuff. Hey, I had a hell of a weekend because I had one of the most intense movie experiences of 2021 so far.
You watched Little Miss Sunshine.
It's unbelievable. Have you seen it? It's good.
It's so violent. It's just so violent. I know, like, and the language. I didn't think I'd see like a live abortion.
It's seriously full on. I mean, when Steve Carell opens fire at the pageant at the end, you're just like, didn't
talk
see it
about
coming.
Having a special set of skills. That was good. And then demasking, and then you realizing that the whole time it was Gary Oldman playing Steve Carell as that role. Oldman is so good. But anyway,
I had the pleasure, and I mean this as a pleasure of watching the gut punch of a movie that is your new film, Coming Home in the Dark. That is an intense watch, huh?
Yeah, it is, and it was interesting. You're making me think of like the first time I watched it, which was online, connected to a link, and I still haven't seen it in a theater yet.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, Sundance. Sundance
was all virtual, right. It was nasty. I mean, because look, man, I'm not a spring chicken. I'm 45, and this was one of those movies that you get, once in a while in your career that is, or just a piece of work that's just incredible, you're incredibly proud of. I was nervous looking at it the first time, and I remember watching it and thinking, oh, I'm actually engaging with this story. I'm not just looking at it and thinking how dreadful I am and the scenes. I mean, I do that with Coming Home in the Dark. Right? I mean, there's moments in there I see and I go, ah, I wish I'd done this, or I wish I'd done that, or I don't think you're ever satisfied. That there are real moments that you see and you think, okay, that's that, and you're able to remove yourself in that sense. But it's the more you know about filmmaking and the more you're part of the process, the less you're able, I think, to enjoy what you do. But it's a testament to the film's power that I can watch it and get engaged, and it. I'm very, very proud of that film, and I loved working with James. And kudos to the New Zealand Film Commission for making that movie, because it's just defiantly challenging to an audience.
It's I'm going to do the little. Do you want to do it? Or shall I do it? I mean, I think one of us should just. I say this. I'm going to be very careful with this because I feel we need to
exactly where you're going.
Yeah, I want to explain to everyone what the film is, without giving a single thing away, because part of the joy of watching Coming Home in the Dark is the slow unraveling reveal of the mystery, let's say. But on the surface, I'll give it a shot and then you can jump in if you like and tell me that there is a little bit more we can say. But it's about a family who go hiking and come across two strangers of a relatively unpleasant variety who then proceed to kidnap the family. End.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing it. Yeah, exactly. That's all you want to say, really. As the movie progresses, you start to realize there might be more to this abduction than you think. As far as I'll go, I'm just sort of I'm flirting with the boundaries there, Alex.
Walking ever so close to the line, but I'm not going to stop.
Yeah, but that's what you need to know. But like the one thing I love about the movie is that if you like anybody can withstand 20 minutes of even the worst film, right? And this happens to be a superb film, I think. And when you, by the time you're 13 minutes deep, you have a choice, like, you know, 13, 14 minutes in, you're like, okay, I guess I'm in. Like you don't have a decision. It just locks you in, and there is no turning around. And I don't think I've seen a film quite like that in a very long time. If I have, I mean, I remember watching Irreversible for the first time. Gus Van Noy's film, you know, and which hits with the same kind of impact, you know, in a different way. And once I realized what I was in and what we were like within that first, I would say 5 or 6 minutes, I was like, oh, I'm in, you know, I've walked into a nightmare and I can't turn around. And that's the last time I felt like that with a movie. But I mean, I'm in the dark. It's deceptive, our categories too, that we give to films, because we've named this film as it's sort of described as a horror or a thriller.
Yeah, I saw that. I was going to bring that up with you, actually. I think people call it a horror, a psychological horror, which I don't think does it justice, because there are some big, big themes at play that, again, I don't really want to get into, but I guess to keep it as loose as possible, there's a fascinating conversation about whether inaction to prevent something bad happening is as bad as the action itself, which I think...
Yeah, if you're an observer or a witness to something to something terrible, does that inculcate? Does that make you? Are you complicit? You know, in the crime, and that's the question. I mean, and that's the thing about James and Eli. You know, is that like the writers, like, you know, they took the short story and they, I think that for the purposes of film, certainly made it far more rich and diverse. That wasn't the question that was asked by the book, which is tremendous in its own way, and it has its own statements, and those themes are maintained within the movie. But this piece of work it belongs to James and Eli. You know, it's not. You know, it's not the same animal, and I love, and nor would James ever make a movie that was strictly a horror. Like, he reads a lot of horror, but he's most fascinated by people who use that as a device to talk about what their thoughts are on the world. Like, you know, he reads. I don't think I've ever met anybody who reads as prolifically as James. I mean, I'm talking about good and what I would consider kind of average stuff. You know, he's amazing. He's a machine, but he's really into thematically things that that's sort of what I love about the film. It really asks you questions, and it doesn't necessarily answer them all for you. You know, it doesn't spoon feed you, and it expects you to be intelligent. I'm really curious to see what the reaction will be to it. You know, I know that. One thing that's pleased me is that even people who haven't liked it, which has been amazingly kind of rare, they're almost angry or embittered or there's something, you know. And for me, I'm like, good. The movie's living with you. Like, for me, if you ask me a film that I saw even three, sometimes I'll be like 15, 20 minutes into a movie before I realize I've seen it before, and it's just that forgettable, you know. The mind has a way of dispensing with that which does not move it, you know. And you cannot watch this film and forget it. I don't care if you even if you believe you hated it, which to me is a beautiful effect that a piece of art can move you that much. But even if you truly believe you hated this movie, it will live with you. Like, there's just no question. You won't ever forget this movie.
No, not at all. I mean, I watched, you know, through for work, I had about 6 movies to watch this week, and it's the only one I still am thinking about on Monday morning. which is a good thing. I think you're right. I think some people, I think there is the potential because there is a certain ambiguity to it that some people might go, oh, I need my definite ending. Yes. I'd argue that I walked away asking questions and having discussions with the person I watched it with about what that could mean and the reasons behind it. And to me, that is what I wanted from this film. I think, you know, I think it delivers a payoff that is worthy of everything that's gone before. That's me. I'm sure some people might go, but what? But what does that mean? Which isn't a bad thing. I'm not saying those people are wrong. No,
I think that's a wonderful thing. Look, you know, look, I have my questions as well. Like there were moments in the script which I really went through with James ad nauseum, you know, like I was like, look, is this it? Like, is this where we're taking this here? Like, not suggesting change necessarily, just saying, are we meeting those needs enough? You know, those are worthy questions, especially before you're about to step in and do what you're going to do, particularly with what I had to do, you know, in that movie. And it required nothing less than complete commitment, you know. But
and no reservations. When you read it, you didn't have any reservations.
No, I knew it was I was frightened of it. It had me. It just the script hits with a lot of the same impact that the film did. But not close. But
when you read, let's call it that moment in that scene. What was did that come off the page? Were you because I know it feels like to watch that scene, and I know the effect it had on me. That apparent in the script?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have said this in several interviews, you know, like I stood on my feet and howled like a banshee. Like I've never done that with a script before. I stood and howled. I mean, like I couldn't believe, like it was incredulity, really. It was just like, you know, because the thing that James plays into that very few filmmakers do, and it's like movies are terrible now. They're the worst.
And what? Do you really think that?
Oh yeah, I think that filmmaking is at an all time. I think that people make terrible films now. I rarely see something that I think is good. I almost never do. There are amusement parks that, you know, that I'm stealing from Scorsese there, but it's just like they're just silly. Television has really upped its game, and you know, according to a sort of a new culture of home theater, you know, there's definitely some great television. I would venture to say that a lot of the best writers are in television, but movies have died. Movies are dead. Like and it used to be that a movie like this was the movie that people would, you know, as we'd say in New Zealand and England, queue up around the block for, you know, that would line up around the block for, you know. And those days are gone. There's nothing. I'm not interested. Look, you know, to discuss what you said before, you said, you know, you left with a whole lot of questions. Well, to me, the question is more important than the answer. It's if you are inviting your audience to be a filmmaker with you in their minds, like if you like, that's a successful film. If you're supplying them with everything, like with a whole lot of answers, you're not engaging them. And I just feel like the responsibility of the artist is to elicit a change in the person observing that art, you know. And there's no, we're condescending our audiences now. We're asking them to, we're beseeching them to be stupid. We're on bended knee saying you're a dummy, and this is what I love about what James has done. Like that, you know. Sorry, I'm on a rant.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I appreciate that. I just wonder, but I mean, I get exactly what you say. But I bet your kids love Marvel movies, right?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So they're a little young, they don't mind being entertained and lost. I'm not saying that films aren't now engaging. They're just terribly acted, and that doesn't even matter anymore. I'm talking about by major stars, you know, the craft has gone out the window.
And I do it's like that joke in Birdman. Birdman's
exceptional, you know.
But the joke where Michael Keaton goes, Renner, they got Renner now. about the MCU.
Or Jeremy Renner. He's a good actor, though. He really is. I've met Jeremy a few times, and I'm not saying that just because I'm acquainted with him, but Jeremy's really good. But the Jeremy Renners are few and far between. But that movie is stunning. I mean, did you see so maybe I'm going to have to eat my fucking words here because there was that beautiful movie. Did you see Roma?
Yes, I did. Alfonso Cuarón. Yeah.
To me, I'm like, oh, okay. So filmmaking's still alive, but like I'll see two or three of those a year, you know, that actually have the sort of the courage to sort of withhold and make you ask those questions. But when it's become pageantry now and demonstration, and people want their escapism and they want to feel good, and it's not the same thing as inviting them into, like, again, just going back to that thing we were saying before about living with movies. You can stop me if I'm boring you, by the way.
This fascinates.
About inviting people to be your co-creator, you know, that's the thing that lives with them. Like, I've seen these Marvel, you know, the movies. Shit, I was in one of them, you know, but I can't.
Oh yes, no. Sorry.
Was rather a good one of the franchise, and it's a total privilege, and I'm super grateful. But it's not asking you anything that terribly deep, and unfortunately, because of the deluge of CG and the beautiful things that computers can now make with the image you're watching. You're sort of even less, and you're engaged in a very superficial level, but it's not going deep, you know.
I understand what you mean, and for the record, I agree. Spider-Man 2, which was obviously at the very start of this, you know, was Sam Raimi, who's had earned his wings, you know, delivering fantastic movies like Evil Dead and have you. I think that I don't mind these sort of big event movies, that the mega movies that cost $200 million, and I think the problem is that we no longer get mid-budget movies in the $60 million mark, maybe, you know, the $50 million mark, which are original ideas but still deliver on that spectacle that we used to get.
You nailed it.
We either have these mega ones, or you're scrabbling around trying to raise, you know, $1 million for your movie, and it's polarized, one or the other. There's no middle ground anymore, which is the unfortunate thing.
You nailed it. So at the end of the mid to late aughts, the Warner Independence, the Paramount Vantages, the, you know, all these smaller independent arms of the studios, because the studios for a period were making very real money out of their $15, $20 million films. These were the movies that Julia Roberts or, you know, Clooney would get greenlit back in those days because they had taste, and they would get these like little films made for a decent budget, and they could be incredibly profitable. And they could not be, you know, like, but what we're seeing now is the hedging of bets. And so studios now are like, you know, when I first came to town, like, you know, Disney was making, you know, a lot of films per year, like, you know, in the early 2000s, they were making, I mean, I don't know, close to 100 or something like that. I mean, they make what now, 2 or 3 movies a year. You know, it'll be a Star Wars film, it'll be a Pixar, and it'll be, you know, it's hedging, it's a business, you know, it's not, so that the world, when that's the driving force, it's, you're not talking about storytelling anymore. You're talking, now I'm with you. Look, I'm not allergic to the large tentpole movie, you know, like I'll watch those and I can switch off and enjoy them, and they can be fine. Particularly when you have kids, you know, they're going to want to watch whatever Pixar has just cooked up or whatever, you know. But in terms of, like, you know, there was a period, particularly the end of the 90s, you know, where larger film, like, look at a film like Fight Club, right? Mm. I mean, like, Fight Club was, you know, was, I mean, Brad was already an enormous star at that point. So was Edward Norton. This was a quote unquote tentpole, but it was really, you know, I think it was the same year. I want to say it's the same year as Three Kings, and, you know, and I believe Magnolia came out that year. And, like, you know, you had these stunning, like, gigantic films with incredible casts that left you, like, and just, like, I still, you know, like, who doesn't think about Fight Club? You know, like, it pierces the social consciousness. We haven't made a movie quite like Fight Club since it was around, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I fundamentally agree with you on all those points. I think Fight Club is kind of unique. I don't think even if we were still making movies that cost, I think Fight Club costs around $60 million. I don't think even if we were making movies for around $60 million based on, you know, a Chuck Palahniuk book. Fight Club is so unique. It's like it's difficult to compare anything to it. I think there are still films coming out. I mean, I guess more importantly, rather than me going, no, there are. It's like you work in this industry, obviously, and how does that make you feel? Because, you know, it must be, I don't want to say depressing, but for the industry, for you to be, I guess, disillusioned with the industry that you actually work within must be quite, you know, quite a melancholy feeling.
No, you need to be instrumental in changing that. You know, it's why I, you know, gambled and took this film, and luckily we're seeing, you know, look, it's made a decent splash thus far. Hopefully it continues to sort of ripple outward, but you can be a participant in that change. You know, look, am I going to take the next film, the next payday for a thing that I don't entirely, it's what people forget about actors. You know, it's always amusing when you're doing interviews and people go, what drew you to this role? And you're like, I need to pay my fucking bills, you know? And, you know, but the truth is, like, yeah, like I'm going to work to survive, you know, that's going to happen, but I'm still also allowed my thoughts, and I'm not going to be ashamed of those thoughts. Mm-hmm. Like we're so politically correct now that we say, well, is this biting the hand that feeds you? Is this, well, I don't know. I'm not specifying anyone or anything. It's just, I know what I'm interested in, and I don't want to be ashamed of having those tastes. I do also think it's important, you know, like I'm writing something right now, which I'm happy to get into development later, you know, which is, and the first thing I think of when I sit down to write every day is what can I put down today that truly terrifies me. That is something that I've never seen before, you know. And because that's really the only place that for me, I'm not saying that everybody else has to have these thoughts. I'm saying I'm again, all of this is personal. But I think that, you know, do I think that it's depressing that I can't go to a movie theater and I'm not sitting with a packed house in front of the equivalent of Last Tango in Paris? Yeah, of course I do, man. Mm-hmm. Of course I find that a bummer. That the Romas of the world aren't nearly held as in high regard as like Avengers Endgame. Sure, like I wish it was a slightly different world like that. But there's always going to be outliers, and there's always going to be the movies that are obscenely popular. But you have to be to my circuitous way of answering this question is, look, just what am I, like, the question is always like, what am I going to do to make that change? Because I'm definitely going to make other commercial things. I've got to survive, but I also want to make certain that every day I'm taking at least, one measured step towards, towards the transformation that I'd like to see.
And that's great. I mean, I don't know whether you've been writing between now and Broken Kingdom, because I remember reading about what an experience that was for you. Unfortunately, I will say this, I can't get Kingdom Come in the UK, where it's not available in the UK, but I am desperate to watch the documentary, just in case anyone doesn't know, the documentary about you for 5 years trying to get your film Broken Kingdom made, which I have seen and I really enjoyed. I think that's a great film.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. We did that on Shoestring. Like, I mean,
it doesn't look like it at all. It's a gorgeous looking film.
Look, it's also has its flaws too. I'll be the first one to say, like, I it's far from perfect. I looked at the, you know, when I haven't looked at the film movie in about 7 or 8 years, and I'm kind of frightened to be honest. But it was also my first movie, you know, and I learned so much. I was very blessed in that closely following that, I got a whole lot of work, which meant that I couldn't do stuff for basically a decade, you know. Mm. And now I'm in a position where I kind of can again. I think, if God willing, and if COVID allows us.
So you are writing again, though. Well, that's cool, because I wondered how long it takes to sort of recover from the process. Because again, reading around it, like, I mean, it sounds like quite a soul-crushing experience, but you did come out the other side with a movie, a good movie.
You're a better artist too, like, when you've had your soul destroyed like that. I was a better actor. You're braver. You're also slightly more frightened in a strange way. You know, my father was in the military, and when he was younger, and he talks about parachute jumps, and said that the first one isn't the scariest. You know, the first leap from the plane isn't the scariest, because you're sort of taking a jump into the unknown. You know, mm-hmm. He goes, it's the second one. He says, this is the second one's the most frightening. And in a way, I equate that to any apprehension I have about my second experience. Because look, you know, out of the gates, we're not all going to be Truffaut with the 400 blows. You know, we're not necessarily all going to be, Jordan Peele's Get Out. You know, like, your first film might not necessarily strike. Put it this way, there's a rift between the talent that you sort of have and what you're seeking to achieve, and sometimes you can't quite span that. Like, sometimes you can't quite nurture into the world something that resembles what you originally thought it was going to be. But now I feel like I I've had much more experience, and I was able to direct during my time on the originals, and I think I know how to do what I would like to do. I think I do. I don't know, but I'm also shit scared.
Hey, that's the best place to be. You got, I think that fear is what drives us forward. It's complacency and sort of an innate satisfaction that dulls the creativity. You know, fear and hunger, I think, go hand in hand, and a desire to change. It sounds like, you know, it sounds like, you know, you're in a place where that's there, you're in the perfect place to make that happen. Like I went through a period where I just sort of went, yeah, and that little shrug there, that meh. And, you know, if you lose sight of going, actually, I want to get better at this. I want to do this. I want to explore this and this and this. And, you know.
So talk to me about what you'd like to do. What's the in terms of the globe on Atlas's shoulder, like what's your, what in terms of what you would like to achieve? Would it be an iteration of this show into something else? Or is-
No. I enjoy doing this because I enjoy talking to people like yourself, people, creatives who make films, who work in this industry. No, I am. I've just, this isn't my, like, look, I always feel a little bit funny about being asked questions just because I'm so not used to it. This is like, I like the control. I'm a massive control freak. So being asked a question. No, I enjoy writing like yourself. I've written a TV series because, like you, I believe TV is a much more exciting medium to explore stuff. It's very early days. It's just been optioned. I'm very proud of it. So, beautiful. You know, touch wood, something will happen with it. But
give me a fucking job.
All right, give me a fucking job. But yeah, I think writing is, as I'm sure you know full well, it's just such an exciting process that when you get into it, it offers an escapism that that is equivalent to watching a great movie, except that you're controlling the plot. To lose yourself in a piece of writing and really, you know, forget time passing.
It's also incredibly lonely, very hard, very demanding. Like there's something. You need to just sort of show up and do what you can. And there are days where you might write pages of work, you know, and maybe it's all shit. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's all great. Who knows? And then there are days where you'll sit there and like, you're lucky if you get a couple of paragraphs. It's inconsistent. It's not quite like going to the gym, although one should approach it with the same attitude, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to do something you've never seen, like truly have never seen, like that becomes really hard, because even as you're writing this thing, you're like, am I deliberately sabotaging this so that it never gets made? But then there's also that part of you that's like, well, don't know, be braver. Say the thing that you really mean, say the thing you want to say. And God knows there are precious few venues to do that anymore. We've become so pathetic. I just think culturally we're so savage to one another, and like art to me is that place where we should take risks and talk about the things that frighten us and challenge us. And there seems to be this, what am I trying to say? I'm not even trying to protect myself by saying this because I don't care. It's just at the moment there seems to be like, if you have these ingredients, then that's a good piece. Or if you have these actors, or if you do this, or if you talk about this subject matter. Like I went and saw that movie Pig the other night. The Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
See, I didn't like it at all. I thought it was like a student film after minute 15. I thought it was beautifully shot. I thought that the premise was really, really interesting. Mm. And I thought that everything thereafter was just kind of amateur hour. I was predicting every scene before it happened. Maybe not the scene where he goes into the sort of the fight club thing.
Okay. Good. Cause that was what I was just about to say.
I didn't predict that. But everything else, every scene, I was saying dialogue before they'd open their mouths. You know, my girlfriend hit me at one point. She could stop saying the lines before they say them. Like, because I knew what was coming. I knew, and that's not. It sounds vicious to sort of say this stuff about like a young filmmaker. I think that film was sold on its premise. Nick Cage didn't do anything in that performance that I like. If you told me what the scene was and said, oh, Nick Cage is in it, I could have visualized in my mind exactly the delivery, exactly what he was going to do. There was no surprise. I like the idea of a man going and searching for his truffle bag. That's, and I think that that film got very lucky with its premise, but it just, it, yeah. And I just, I was like,
did you know,
well, that's,
you
that's
know,
sort of what's, that's sort of what's selling films now. It's that gimmick. Now, no, you can make that argument about Coming Home in the Dark too. Like people will say, well, there's something that's startling in the beginning, you know? And, mm-hmm. you know, again, we won't ruin that, but I think that it carries over the finish line something kind of interesting and challenging.
It does, but I mean, look, you know, it's not my battle to fight, but on the subject of Pig, I mean, the end crushed me. Like you say that you predicted every scene. I did not predict which way it was going to fall at the end in terms of, you know, whether it would be. I'm trying to talk about this without spoiling Pig for anyone, but
I'm going to be crucified for saying this stuff to you. Crucified.
I don't think you are,
I don't care. Like it's interesting. It's like, because it's just, there's such an overwhelming response to that movie. And it's just like, no, that's not, you know, go and watch some Chan Park Wook, or go and watch, you know, that there are, and I sound like a snob now, but I don't care. It's I'm sorry, I interrupted. You were saying.
No, not at all. I mean, I can't speak for everyone. For me, it's a very simple thing of, you know, I love a movie where the protagonist is more interested in a pig than he is in people. And
and that's the premise. And that was great. And that's the great nobility and virtue of that piece. And the first 15 minutes are stunning. Like, it's stunning. Like, the greatest scenes were between him and the pig. That pig was adorable, and I loved that relationship. I could have done a lot more of the movie with him and the pig.
It's weird the scene that you didn't see coming is actually with the Chef Fight Club. Is the only scene that I think actually, excuse me, is the scene that felt like a student film. It felt like a funny idea that really was, you know, didn't go anywhere. It felt like, hey, what if there was a Chef Fight Club? And it was just like, but why and what and everything else? I was totally on board with it. And like I said, I liked it, but it's weird that the one thing that is the unexpected turn was too much for me. Like, now, whether that's because I've become conditioned to sort of go, but why, you know, and I was actually having this conversation with someone today. It's like, you know, where do you draw the line, excuse me, between doing something original just because it's original? And where do you go, but actually an audience will understand this better, even if it is more wrote and it's been done before, and they're, you know, they've seen it before, but that's why it's there. And just to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater to make the point of going, but you've never seen this, isn't necessarily great filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, and is there going to ever be a consensus about what's great filmmaking? I mean, I've walked out of some films and thought, like what is a David Lynch film, right? And yet I have to watch everyone, and they pierce your consciousness in a way, your subconscious in a way that is truly haunting. Like, I don't know what the fuck. I do not know what the fuck Lost Highway is about. It doesn't stop me from watching it. Honestly, I'll watch it four times a year, because I just can't get enough of that movie. And like, he shot one on video called Inland Empire, and he didn't even shoot it on HD. He shot it on a DV camera, and that movie is stunning. Like, it's almost kind of better because he shot it lo-fi. Like, what is it about that guy's creation that makes each scene compelling? I was watching that brand new Cherry Flavor thing the other night. It's a show on Netflix.
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I haven't watched it.
It's really interesting, and I love Catherine Kinnear and everything. And I can see a lot of the influence of Lynch in that film. And I was watching it thinking, I turned to my girlfriend at one point and I said, why isn't this as compelling as a David Lynch? Like, why when I'm watching Twin Peaks do I want the next scene and the next scene, even if it's inane or silly, because he's quite quirky and funny and goofy, you know, at times. Why is it with Lynch's work that we want the next moment, you know. So, you know, like, I'm not the hugest Tarantino fan in the world, but I want the next moment. You know, why is it that these guys can compel you into this next moment? And I kind of was like, well, that's an art, you know, that's beautiful skill. I do think that the answer is that they've got something to say. I do think that most filmmakers today, and this, you know, don't, you know, Bergman said this at the end of his life. He said, you know, like, he was talking about young filmmakers from his little island of Faro off the coast of Sweden, you know, and he was saying, look, you know, I see a lot of these aspiring filmmakers and young filmmakers, and he goes, they can do things with a camera. It's positively gymnastic. I can't do the things that they can do, and they're beautiful. And some of them are visually more talented than I have ever been, you know, but I always felt like I had something to say, and he just sort of leaves it hanging in the air there. I think this is the last interview he did before he died. And it's true. It's like Bergman was always saying something. I'm not, you know, we can always sort of superimpose what we're saying about the world onto things afterwards. I mean, I heard Guy Ritchie the other day doing an interview with Joe Rogan, and yes, I was listening to Joe Rogan. I was curious to hear. And Guy's incredibly charismatic and enchanting, and he was talking about storytelling, and I was thinking, that's interesting that you're this deep. Like I didn't, you know, because, and I guess I'm of the generation where I saw sort of Lock, Stock and Snatch, you know, so clearly I need to watch some of his films as he's matured, you know, but it's interesting his philosophy, his approach to
I weirdly enough, I had exactly the same surprise with him. I interviewed him for a very long time, and I was on the set of one of his films, and I got to interviewing him, and he was more engaging than I'd expected, isn't what I meant, but very much more interested in the power of film and the reasoning behind what he was doing at various points in his life and when he was ready to tell certain stories and why each story was the right time for him to tell, which was fascinating. You know, it's slightly lessened by the fact we were on the set of King Arthur, but if you take that out of the equation, it was still a very valid point.
Yeah, man. It's interesting. I'm conscious of the time. I have to go.
You've got to go, man.
I just want to let you know I have 15 minutes and then I have to go.
You have 50 minutes. Well, listen, the one thing I did want to say is we haven't really sort of talked about, I mean, you've touched on Mandrake, the character you play in this movie. I've been reading a lot of what's been written about it, and people are, and I will include myself in this, people is are very, very like, this is an incredible calling card for you, which sounds weird because obviously you've been acting for quite some time now, but this does feel like a departure for you in terms of anything I've seen you do on screen before. Do you feel like that? And do you feel that this is a new chapter for you as an actor in terms of what this role has, well, not what it's done for you yet, because the movie's out next month, but what it has done for you yourself?
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that, man. That's incredibly kind of you to say. And yeah, of course, man, that was the reason for doing it. Like, you know, the problem with becoming really well known for a certain couple of roles, you know, and by the way, I'm incredibly grateful for those roles, is that you become sort of iconically attached to that persona and that idea. I mean, it's no accident that, you know, there were some offers, you know, in the wake of that, that were very much like, you know, Elijah from The Vampire Diaries or the originals. And then it's interesting with, I've seen, there's been a couple of things which have come in recently, clearly people have seen Coming Home, you know, and I've gone from like, you know, character description being dapper, a gentleman, clean cut, like, you know, selective with words, and to mountain man, like grubby, fucking, like just reprobate, like a filthy, almost a transient looking, you know, hobo. Like it's amazing how little imagination people have. And so stereotyping is it's a phenomenon, and we have to wrestle with it. And yet I'm grateful that I have that phenomenon to wrestle with. But yes, I do. Well, of course, I would love things to change. You know, I'm old enough and ugly enough to be able to say that I'm good. You know, that I know I'm good. Like, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think I was. And if this can open any doors to worlds that are more interesting to me, then yeah, of course I'm incredibly excited about that. You know, I also think I'm terrible, by the way. I'm not just saying that as a chaser to sort of douse it with some humility. I am. You know, rarely am I satisfied with the performance I did, but I know that I invest hard and I want, you know, any creature that I bring to the screen to feel like you know him somehow or that you could encounter him.
That's funny. Well, not funny, like terrifying. I think one of the most chilling things about Mandrake, in Coming Home in the Dark is the fact, and it's interesting to know how you go about doing that, because you walk so close to this line of, you know, of being a sort of, you know, he is a villain, he's a psychopath. And yet he's just the right kind of psychopath, in so much as the chilling quality is he doesn't exist in the world of horror movies. He exists in our world, in the real world. He is someone who you could genuinely believe in the most horrible circumstances you could stumble across. How do you go about making sure you don't cross that line into, I don't want to use the word cartoon, but too much yeah. of a movie villain?
You know, I'm not sure I didn't, but there was one, it's interesting because I did my very best to make him as human and as, I didn't want him to be like Rutger Hauer in the Hitcher, you know. I was frightened of that. Which, by the way, I think is marvelous performance. But I didn't want to be, I had to love him, you know. Like You have to love these people, and it's kind of part of what I love about what I do. I love my job because you're finding love and compassion for these otherwise like ostensibly reprehensible and repulsive creatures. It teaches you compassion for yourself, because God knows most of us carry around with us a litany of things that we'd like to see changed about ourselves, because there's a hole in each of us, as Charlie Kaufman says, there's a hole in each of us, and we recognize that hole, you know. to insert sexual joke there. You know, I guess what I'm saying is like I love my job because I guess the first thing I try and do is find some kind of love for them, like some kind of affection, and also to recognize that they're a product of their circumstances and not just as you say, a cartoon of evil. You know, I'm not sure that I believe in evil people. I just believe in the sum total of evil circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that's the incredible thing about this performance. And I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I'm just saying the fact that scene, in inverted commas, at the start, for that to happen, and you to be the architect behind that scene, and yet for me to feel sympathy for that very same character later on in the film, I think is quite an achievement. In performance.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. But credit where credit's due. The architect was James and our DP. But I was certainly one of the builders on the yard.
Yeah,
it's very sweet of you to say, man.
Worries, man. So what's next? What are you up to next? Are you going to finish your script? Are you got the job lined up?
I think I have a job lined up, which of course I can't discuss. I met with somebody just recently who's going to be a showrunner on a very interesting little show, and we'll see if that takes flight. She already has her investors surrounding her, and whatever reason she believes that I can be one of the central components of that. So that's kind of exciting, but I can't talk about that for at least another couple of months.
Based on our conversation earlier, it's not going to be Transformers, the TV series or anything like that, is it?
Oh, shit, I would kill for that. I would love it. Is there a Transformers TV series?
No. I just meant I've tried to think of the biggest, dumbest movies I could and turn it into a TV series.
I do all of them. Like, I'm a total fucking whore. And I have no shame about that. It doesn't mean that I don't think that doesn't mean that I'm not sad that the movies have sort of become what they've become. But also, too, we can't even go into cinemas now. So what's the, you know,
are they not open there?
They are open. They are open here. That there's obviously like distancing rules and things like that. You know, it's just, you know. I think people are wary too. They're not going to the movies in droves. I mean, people have learned, especially during COVID, that they can watch, they have their cinematic experience at home. And I don't think there's
terrible. It's terrible, which is another reason why. And I guess we'll end with this because you got to go. But I will say that one of the reasons that I knew Coming Home in the Dark was such an intense watch. I hate myself for this, but you know, you're sitting on your sofa. It's not like the movie theater. So you've got your phone sitting there on the arm of the chair, and I'm guilty of it. If I am not engaged with a movie, I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to check my emails. And I'm loath to say that, but it's true. And I didn't do that once. Not once.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know, man. That's good. Yeah, it's pretty impossible after the scene. Hey, man, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, man. It's really, really incredible to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed our chat. It's been lovely. And I wish you all the best with your writing, with your acting, and congratulations again on the film. It is, it's a must see in my book, out in October.
Thank you so much, buddy.
Have a great day, buddy.
You too, Alex. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.